What does it mean to be rich? Is it having more stories to share or time to give? Is it being able to keep your loved ones close or travel somewhere far away? At Edward Jones, we believe the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Your dedicated financial advisor will take a comprehensive approach to your financial strategy to help support what truly matters to you. EdwardJones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Live from the Nasdaq market site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. Stocks sink, yields spike, major markets closing near the lows of the day. The Dow down more than 2,000 points from its all-time high, less than 50 points from going negative for the year. Meantime, the 10-year surging once again, climbing to five-month highs above the 4.6% mark. Is the sell-off all from rising tensions in the Middle East? Is there more downside to come? Plus, Tesla tanks. Shares of the automaker closing at their lowest level since last May as the EV maker slashes jobs and faces some real competition in the green car space. What is next for Elon Musk's company, and can the stock get revved back up? And later, Goldman glistens after big earnings and a revenue beat. Software stocks glitch as investors seem wary of a potential Salesforce deal. And not so godlike, the once unstoppable United Health has seen its shares drop 15% this year. Will earnings tomorrow help turn things around? We'll debate all of that. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Dan Nathan, and Rebecca Patterson, former chief strategist at Bridgewater Associates. Welcome, Rebecca. And we start off with a steep market reversal that sent stocks to their lows of the day. The Dow up 400 points early in the session, closing the day down nearly 250. That was its biggest single day about face in 13 months. The Nasdaq tumbling almost 2%, and the S&P 500 fell more than 1%. Meantime, the 10-year Treasury yield hitting its highest level since mid-November. The volatility index climbing back above 19, and the dollar jumping to its own five-month high. All this as investors eye the potential of Israel retaliating against Iran's weekend strike. So how vulnerable are stocks for more downside here? Tim, what do you say?
Well, what's interesting to me is we came in this morning and equity futures last night, I'm sure most people are glued to their screens after the weekend's events, and we are seeing a rally. And we are seeing a rally also with possibly a move higher in rates. And that was really how we started out this morning. And I recognize that markets price in a lot. We priced a lot in Friday afternoon going into this weekend on the expectation of, unfortunately, what happened happening. Having said that, it was a week where we sold off on the back of yields. I mean, it was a week where we sold off on the back of a handful of things. But when you started to see the day play through and there was no flight to quality in bonds, which should have meant Treasury should have been rallying, the dollar should have been rallying. The dollar actually at one point was actually off small. But the fact that some of the trades that I would have expected to have seen this morning hadn't taken place, I just found is weird, even though I know we were in a place where Friday afternoon risk was significantly high. Look, the VIX has closed well through the levels on Friday. I think we are in a kind of a new range here. The S&P closed effectively on the lows after 120-point reversal intraday to close through the 50 to the downside, and it hasn't made a move to the downside through the 50 since September of 23. So I think we're in an environment where not only have we had a 4% move already in the S&P from peak to trough, but I think unfortunately we've crossed a Rubicon over the weekend. We haven't been here before with Iran, Israel. I think there are all kinds of implications, and I think there some of them are even going to we're going to kind of contemplate that tonight.
Meaning Iran has never attacked Israel before, directly as opposed to through surrogates, and that's the Rubicon that we have crossed over the weekend.
That's the Rubicon we've crossed, and I think there's left side tail risks galore.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, and I agree with you. I mean, we have geopolitical risks in multiple places around the world, and you would think that that would lead to a flight to quality, which would pull yields lower. But we have other forces going on right now. The retail sales report, very, very strong, stronger growth, risks of higher oil prices from the Middle East, creating inflation expectation risks that could keep short-term rates higher for long. All of that's feeding into the long end of the curve. I think the big deal, though, today is the speed of the move. You know, if you have a very slow rise in yields and it's backed by stronger growth, you can see higher yields and higher stocks at the same time. When you have a fast rise in yields, it's unsettling. You have greater uncertainty, greater vol, and it's not necessarily coming just from better growth. I think that's when that tips the balance, the correlation the other way.
So all of that I totally agree with, but I also think this market was on such a tear that at some point you need an excuse to start selling things off. So we're just sort of at the beginning of earnings season. I think if things calm down, that's a giant if, and we get back to focusing on earnings, that could be good for the market, but it wouldn't surprise me to just continue to see down for a while. As you're this move in rates is really quite something. I don't know how much to attribute to the retail number, which was super strong. Also, the revisions to the prior months were up huge.
They're seen as more important, too.
Yeah, and why are they so off? I don't quite get that. So that's kind of, you know, as you were saying, you could have rising rates and the economy doing okay and the market sort of doing okay there. But this retail number seemed to actually be a negative, right? Just for what it did to rates.
It decelerated a lot. I mean, I'll just say this. You just said, Karen, you know, you want to focus on earnings. And again, I go back to Friday and J.P. Morgan down 6.5%. I can't remember the last time I've seen that stock down more than 5% in a non-crisis sort of period. So what does that say? It's a very crowded trade. We've been talking about a lot of very crowded trades. They became very big market cap stocks. So this was a $500 billion market cap that was down 6% on a technical basis, broke trends. And let me tell you something. There's a lot of stocks, a lot of sectors, a lot of indices that are breaking these really very nice 45-degree uptrends that have been in place since October. So some of the technicals are starting to break down. And I just feel like once we get into earnings, I think expectations for so many stocks, we're only down 4% in the S&P from those all-time highs just made 2 weeks ago. I think expectations are high. What the geopolitics situation does to me, it muddies the outlook, right? And so if J.P. Morgan sold off because the CEO, the best CEO on the planet, right, was giving the sort of guidance that investors were not going to feel great about, and he was already telegraphing that earlier in the week with his investor letter, then I think there's more big downdraft for some single names that are very crowded to come. And again, they could have put up a really good Q1, but it really might be about just the lack of visibility they have in the future. And then if you just think about this, okay, we have high expectations for earnings growth for the S&P 500, 11, 12%. If you have the dollar where it is, you have rates where they are, you have commodities where they are, I mean, this is going to start to put some pressure on margins, right? And that's going to put downward pressure on earnings. You know, so I think we're going to have downward earning revisions and that are going to come out of this. And so, again, the S&P just seems a bit mispriced, you know, in and around 5,100 or so. The last time we were 4.6 in the 10-year, the S&P was 4,600.
Would I make a leap if I were to say that you're thinking of stagflation at this point?
Yeah, I mean, like, that's it. We've been talking about that for a while. You could have said it a year ago and sounded really smart, and you just weren't really smart. You know what I mean? But now I think a lot of these price increases seem to be at least wages and some of these supply chain issues and reshoring, they're going to be embedded in the economy right here. And one of the reasons why I thought the Fed should figure out how to raise that inflation target, it's going to give them a bit more leeway what they can do with monetary policy.
And you had a bank, UBS, out there saying that, look, their base case has gone from 5 to 2 cuts this year, but they said you could be at 6.5 Fed funds next year if a resilient economy, so not stagflation, but actually the retail sales number. I think I think Rebecca's dead on in terms of the impact of that retail sales number was very, very important, coincident with everything else this morning. And so whether, you know, we've now already explored that concept of what would rate hikes look like. They would look like a 10 to 15% correction in equities, I think, almost no matter what you did, based upon where we have been. But the fallout from the weekend's events are that oil, which was already undersupplied, I think it's higher for longer, which short term is very inflationary, even though that's medium term actually deflationary, because I think it actually will impact oil and oil demand. But in the short run, you know, headline CPI every $10 barrel move, there's a lot of these metrics out there that say it's about a 40 basis point move on headline CPI and about 4 bips on core. I think the argument in terms of equities, there was an argument with higher yields and kind of where we were. We had Goldilocks, right? We had an economy that was doing what it was doing.
Goldilocks is dead.
Goldilocks is dead. Good thing guy's not here.
At least in a coma.
Yeah.
Goldilocks is in a coma.
But that was great for banks. Yeah. That was great for energy. Right. Like, those are environments where those sectors were the ones you wanted to own. Now you can make an argument it's tough.
Yeah. In terms of flight to safety, though, if you were to position for a flight to safety, what would that be? I mean, if Treasuries, as you mentioned, a basket of factors there, including issuance, that's going to be a huge pressure.
I mean, gold obviously is rallying. Mm-hmm. It's having a great year. I think there's probably more upside. And what I like about gold right now is it's not just the flight to safety. There's also support coming from China, from the central bank continuing to add to reserves, and Chinese consumers who are not knowing anywhere else to put their money. And I just saw over the weekend that Costco is now selling gold bars, and they're selling out like that, which is interesting. But I like it because even if peace breaks out, which would be amazing, there's this underlying support that's going to help your downside.
So I was surprised that we didn't see the flight to quality also, which would be more likely in the shorter end of the curve, right? Not wanting to take an interest rate bet, but just a quality bet. So we didn't really see that. That was sort of interesting to me. I think that, you know, this sort of rhetoric back and forth is terrible, right? And if you're uncertain, you just seem like, all right, I'd rather just take risk off the table. I don't do that. I'm long, always long. So, you know, Friday today, it wasn't delightful, but I think that the longer the message is away from earnings and how actual companies are doing, the worse it is.
Yeah, I'll just say this. You guys mentioned the retail sales. I mean, you know, over the last couple months, we've heard from McDonald's, we heard from Starbucks. They were blaming weak sales because of the Middle East thing. So if you think about the retail sales here in the U.S., you better hope the U.S. consumer, you know, holds up here. Because if the S&P finally does have, let's say, a 10% downdraft, that is the sort of thing that weighs on consumer confidence here. If the geopolitics stuff, if we really have two hot situations right now, think about those two regions are going to be impacted. And then you have U.S. multinationals that are dealing with higher costs of, supply chain stuff, dollar, all that sort of stuff. It just, we can find ourselves really quickly in finally in a little bit of a correction. I know that sounds like, you know, I'm speaking Greek to you people here, but it just seems like it's going to happen sooner or later. But to the point, it's been very orderly right now. I mean, you're down 4% in the S&P 500. There is no reason, I mean, to be panicked about anything.
I think the thing to watch on your point is the higher end consumer. The lower end consumer is already really struggling. What's supporting the retail consumer broadly is the people who own lots of stocks and who own homes. And that tends to be the top 20% of the economy. So they've had the most wealth creation. They're allowed to keep spending. The savings rate, by the way, continues to tick down. Yeah. We're now at 3.6%. We were at 4.3%, I think, last summer. So that excess savings we all used to talk about is largely gone. And we're getting a bigger cohort at the bottom of the income spectrum that's really not able to spend very much. So it could tip pretty easily. If stocks fall, that confidence on the higher end is gone.
And consumers are carrying credit card debt. They're carrying balances now. And what are rates on credit cards? They're at highs. And with every tick higher, they go higher. They adjust higher.
I think there's a trade here in a lot of those consumer finance companies that were great trades last summer into the fall when rates peaked. Even some of the mortgage servicers, Dunlop Walker, Synchrony, and some of the consumer credits, Rocket Mortgage. I mean, there's a lot of names. Do your work. But I think these were trades that were very popular when yields were moving aggressively. And we were making a call on the consumer that we've all been a little bit early on, but we're starting to.
Well, here's one. I mean, American Express reports on Friday morning. So we talk about some of the cross currents that we've heard on the higher end here. And to your point about the stock market, which is making a lot of people feel pretty good, baby boomers. I was talking to our good friend Peter Buchvar today. You know, they got money at 5% there. They got their houses at all-time highs. They got all this sort of stuff. Let's see what American Express has to say. It doubled the performance of the S&P 500 off the October lows. It was up 60% from its lows to its highs, and the S&P was just, up just, 30 or so percent. So that one, to me, is going to be on my radar Friday morning.
Let's turn now to the escalating tensions in the Middle East. Israel's defense minister saying today his nation has no choice but to retaliate after this weekend's drone and missile attacks by Iran. Our next guest predicts Israel will respond, but with missiles only aimed at Iranian military infrastructure. Here now is Brookings Institution senior fellow Michael O'Hanlon. Michael, great to have you with us.
Thank you. Nice to be with you, although it's always dangerous to make predictions. So. I'll try to soften that specific one. Yes.
But in terms of Israel striking back at this point, will that end it or will this just be a continuous sort of tit for tat at this point?
Yeah, that's the question. I think that Israel, the reason why I think Israel will do something specific, prompt, but also limited, is that I think Israel feels it has to now reciprocate because Iran has attacked Israel's own soil from Iranian soil for the first time. And Israel doesn't like to be on the soft or short end of that kind of a stick. It believes strongly in the concept of reestablishing deterrence, meaning showing you're the tough guy and intimidating people into hopefully not attacking you again. Now, that logic would suggest that Israel might actually escalate dramatically like they did in Gaza. But I think it's more likely in this case, having intercepted and have the U.S. and other help in intercepting the Iranian attack, they'll feel it's adequate to do something that is firm, but also de-escalatory, and hope that therefore Iran will not itself feel the need to then go one more time afterwards. So that's my prediction that, probably missiles because there's no man. There's no manned aircraft involved, no potential for shoot down, probably fixed infrastructure that missiles are good at hitting, and probably relatively isolated infrastructure to minimize fatalities, maybe at night, and probably nothing too major, probably not the nuclear installations, for example, or any major ports or airfields. But we'll see.
let's say a strike back by Israel concludes this particular chapter of the conflict, Michael. What have we learned, though? I mean, we've learned that Iran has missiles that can reach Israel at this point. So in terms of what we called crossing the Rubicon earlier, the first attack by Iran directly on Israel, what does this sort of open the door to in the future in your mind?
Well, I think in technological terms, if I could take that angle, the simplest thing it proves is that medium range air and missile defense is quite good today. And the United States and Israel and others have really perfected or at least dramatically improved a lot of the technology. However, long range missile defense is still hard. That's not particularly relevant here, but it could be if China or North Korea attacked us. And short range defense against saturation attacks with just huge numbers of drones or short range missiles or artillery is also very hard. And really, therefore, the Lebanon Hezbollah threat to Israel remains very potent. So there's nothing that anybody should be doing now about rejoicing that somehow defense has established dominance comprehensively. I don't think that's the case. I think Israel knows better than to think that it's somehow now impervious to Hezbollah attack from Lebanon. There are so many short-range threats that remain because they can get through just by sheer force of numbers, if nothing else.
Hey, Michael, it's Tim. Thanks for joining us. You could make an argument that Vladimir Putin is looking at all this with a big smile on his face. And I guess my question to you is not predictions on the rest of the world, but also the impact of what's going on in the Middle East and how that's skewing political policy, political response, budgeting, financing, different parts of the world. But again, where this can spread or impacts to other parts of the world that we are also very concerned about right now.
Yeah, it's a good question, Tim. You know, there's a lot of ways this could play, but you may be right that Putin's smiling for various reasons. I could also see a case, however, that this may be what is needed to shake Congress up into action on both Ukraine and Israel aid, because Israel's now going to have had, you know, have fewer air defense capabilities still in its toolkit or in its quiver, having used up a fair number. I guess they got a lot of help from us, so maybe they didn't use quite as many anti-ballistic missile interceptors as they might have, but that's still a pretty scarce resource. Iran used more than 100 ballistic missiles. So the Arrow 3 interceptor, the various interceptors that we used against that kind of capability, you know, those are easily exhausted. And so there is a case here that now Congress really should act more quickly on Israel. And maybe if it does so, it will also focus on Taiwan and Ukraine as it should. But, you know, hoping for good behavior by Congress is obviously not always the best bet.
Some have made the case, Michael, that Iran won't, you know, make any moves that will embroil it into a longer conflict with Israel simply because they don't have the finances to do so and that it would really backfire in terms of control of their own populace. And I'm wondering how much we should count on that as a sort of self-deterring factor in this.
Not that much, but it's not a zero effect because we know that Iran did the nuclear deal in 2013 and then it kicked in 2015 after we had squeezed them so hard that most of their trade was impaired in some way and more than $100 billion in their assets was inaccessible to them. So therefore, they decided to do a deal that, you know, is probably 51-49 in terms of favorability for us. I was not a enthusiastic supporter of that, although I thought we should have stayed in it once we had it. But, you know, Iran didn't give us the best possible terms. They insisted on some limitations expiring in 2023 and 2025 on their nuclear activity, which is part of why so many Republicans were against it. Also, of course, it didn't limit their other activities in the region. So Iran has proven by its past behavior that it does feel economic pain, but not so much as to just turn over and cry uncle. They still negotiated quite hard and got a pretty good deal for themselves back in that experience of a decade ago. So that they care somewhat about their economy and their own people, but not that much.
Michael, great to have you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Take
Michael
care.
Hanlon of Brookings. How should we assess where we are at this point versus where we were on Friday, Rebecca?
We're mired in uncertainty. I mean, I don't think that's changed at all. And I hope he's right that whatever happens next is small and targeted and that's the end of this and there's no more tit for tat. But, I mean, he would admit if he were sitting with us, he doesn't know for sure. No one does. So you have to, I think you have to assume that we have just moved up a little bit in level of uncertainty that we're dealing with. And so that flows through to what do you want to own? How high a conviction do you have in what you have? How concentrated do you want to be?
Yeah. What do you want to own?
Well, I tell you, you know, back to energy and some of the things like financials. The one thing that's also clear is that Europe suffers here more than anybody. This is an economy that was starting to actually get their sea legs back. The energy prices have come down dramatically. This is bad news for Europe. Interesting day back to the broader market is that you had NASDAQ 100, you had triple Qs underperform. Typically, we think they'd be pretty defensive here. At least they've shown that. Although, in a market that's seen disproportionate move by the mega cap techs, if it's just a pullback and a people dialing back risk. So I think we have to watch those moves because, again, the leadership of this market, we know where it's come from. We also know what's proven to be defensive at other times. I'm not running from energy here, that's for sure.
One thing I'd add to that is it's important to remember that the U.S. is now a net energy exporter, right, since 2019. And so even though this is bad for us, and we saw that today, to your point, it's worse for a lot of other countries.
Like Japan.
Right. And we are seeing the dollar higher. And probably Japan's doing better than it would have otherwise simply because dollar yen is now at its highest level since 1990. The yen weakness helps the exporters there. But I think the dollar staying strong, all else equal, is going to be something that's with us for a bit.
All right. Coming up, earnings, layoffs, and more earnings. Goldman getting a boost after a beat before the bell, Tesla laying off a big chunk of its workforce, and a look into UNH as we gear up for healthcare results, all that ahead on Fast. But first, Apple's iPhone shipments getting sliced in the first quarter, how Chinese challengers are putting pressure on the tech titan. That's next. Don't go anywhere. More Fast Money in two.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee, right here on CNBC.
Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones, from powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY, a big idea that inspired the world to invest differently, and still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Apple shares slumping after new IDC data showed first quarter iPhone sales dropping nearly 10% globally from last year's levels. The drop in sales means Samsung regained its place at the top of the global smartphone market after losing its crown to Apple last year. Among the biggest gainers in market share are China's Transsion and Xiaomi, gaining a whopping 85 and 34% respectively. I feel like we've been talking about this sort of version of the story of Apple losing market share, particularly in China, for a very long time. And these numbers confirm it, Dan.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't help that they just don't have the sorts of products that are on the tip of a lot of consumers' tongues right now. You know, Samsung is out with a phone that they're saying is AI. You know, some of these local, that Xiaomi phone is all the rage in China. And it used to be, you know, 10 years ago, everyone wanted, it was an aspirational thing to have an iPhone. When you think about how just, you know, mobile computing has shifted in the last 10 years, it really is about software and ecosystems. And we know that China has leaned into that really hard. It's just a different market. So to me, this doesn't surprise me given how expensive these phones are in China. And again, this is sad to say, but Apple's products across the board just seem really tired right now. And really, the way to rejuvenate your products is to have something that everything's in the moment, and that is generative AI, and they don't have that right now.
Just last week, it was rallying based on this report that they're going to refresh their MacBooks and everything with an AI-enabled chip, and all of a sudden that pixie dust is just gone. Poof.
Well, it could come back before June 10th, right?
Yeah. True.
So they've certainly raised the bar for June 10th. They've got to come up with something that's really inspiring and gets people really excited because, I mean, the stocks come in a fair amount, but it is not cheap, especially when you take out the hardware part of the PE. The rest of it's really expensive and sort of the bloom somewhat off the rose. I don't know that they'll get back to having that premium multiple, more premium multiple even, without some sort of very significant product. on June 10th.
So slow little kind of slivers or cuts into the Apple story, which includes no longer the largest market cap in the world. It's no longer the largest, the obvious, you know, global play in China. Samsung, we forget, was the dominant play until Apple ascended past them. It's also not surprising. And you can be sure that the Chinese national champion, Xiaomi, is going to be there. I mean, I would be amazed if they're not number two before they're number four.
Yeah, and the China news to me just doesn't feel that surprising. I mean, it was middle of last year when the government came out and banned foreign phones in a lot of workplaces. And that's beyond the ban, it's the signaling to the consumer. And then, of course, the Chinese consumer doesn't want to spend on anything right now. So between those two factors, this isn't shocking to me.
There's a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
Earnings season is underway, and Goldman just set the bar pretty high. What those results mean for the stock and how the rest of the banks will fare this week. Plus, Tesla stock sliding as the company lays off thousands around the world. How those cuts will impact the EV maker and what CEO Elon Musk had to say about the downsizing. You're watching Fast Money live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Goldman Sachs popping nearly 3% today after reporting Q1 earnings that trounced Wall Street expectations. Earnings per share coming in at $3 above estimates, revenue beating by more than $1 billion, the bank's biggest revenue beat since 2021. Those results fueled by gains in Goldman's fixed income and investment banking businesses. Overall profit increasing by 28% from the same period a year ago. Schwab, by the way, also climbing almost 2% today off its Q1 earnings. That stock hitting a new 52-week high, though closing below those levels. Your choice, Tim, which one?
I'd stay with Goldman. I think if we get to a place where we're Schwab is just it's apples and oranges to me in terms of investment. I know you're not saying they are the same. I just look at what Goldman's done. We've seen debt capital markets come back alive. We've seen what they're doing even in their M&A and their underwriting, and they're taking market share. They're not giving it back. It's always been, It's always been the gold standard, and it is Goldman. So I you know, to me, in the environment, it's had a massive, massive run. It's not terribly cheap, but you know, it's kind of in line to its long-term average here.
Mm-hmm. Return on equity was a huge improvement for Goldman Sachs. Does the idea that investment banking business will improve should rates come down, does that change now that Fed cuts are sort of dwindling? Expectations are?
I think just a steady state expectation is what you need, not necessarily where the rates are. So this volatility probably helpful for trading desks, but not so helpful on the M&A front as people get scared. But I mean, it was a good, I mean, very big beats, which they haven't done in a while. I mean, kudos to them. I think I like JP Morgan. I thought their call was very conservative. And a lot of things were very good in the quarter, but they really wanted to downplay that. And they have way more capital than they need. They could lever that up, but they want to be very conservative.
Right.
Morgan Stanley, I mean, this should kind of bode well. I think the Goldman numbers and the contrast between JP Morgan on Friday, they report tomorrow before the open. And, you know, this stock got slammed on Friday. You know, it's interesting to me to look at JP Morgan's performance relative to, say, some of the other money centers. I know a couple of reported and the like. And Morgan Stanley really got hit kind of hard. So if this one was down, and again, a down market, whatever the fears are, rising interest rates, I mean, Morgan Stanley is probably one that you want to buy on a pullback here. So to me, I'm probably more inclined on the investment banks than some of the big money center banks.
You're not worried about the investigations?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know.
It's a money laundering, et cetera.
I mean, I don't know. It seems like every one of these banks has one of those things here or there. I'm right or no?
Well,
I mean, like,
you know. I do think that the market has shrugged a little bit at that in the last couple of days. I do think that the AML is no joke in terms of where the regulators have to stay focused and will you know, do something. But I just think it's, you know, Morgan Stanley was really trading sideways for 2 years after being the dominant outperformer in that group. And I think that's the bigger story.
All right. Coming up, Tesla cutting jobs, the EV maker slashing 10% of its workforce. As shares continue to struggle, but the presumed cost cuts aren't helping the stock this time. Why investors are responding a bit differently. That's next. Plus, a potential data deal. Salesforce dropping on reports it is looking to scoop up another software company. What the acquisition could mean for CRM straight ahead. Fast Money's back in two.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Stocks dropping to start the week as tensions in the Middle East weigh on markets. The Dow falling nearly 250 points, its sixth day of losses in a row. That's its longest losing streak since last June. The S&P down more than 1%, and tech getting hit hard, the hardest. The NASDAQ is down about 1.8%. Shares of Intel, though, getting a boost. Analysts at Citigroup adding a positive catalyst watch on the chipmaker ahead of earnings next week. Intel still down nearly 28% this year. Boeing lower again today. That stock now on an 11-day losing streak, tying its longest downside streak on record. It still has not had an up day in April. Boeing's Senate safety hearing scheduled for this Wednesday. And shares of Trump's media stock sinking more than 18% today. The company filing to issue millions of additional shares of stock. DJT now down more than 57% this month. You have been following this.
I have, just because it's the most ridiculous thing, the whole structure. So they filed to register shares to, they're going to call the warrants soon. I think they can do it probably as early as Tuesday. And so if you own a warrant, you put up your 1150 and you get a share of stock. They registered those shares. Plus, registering the shares of Trump, everyone else, anyone else who lent them money, who's getting shares, they just want to clear the deck for everyone to be able to sell as soon as they can, it would seem. Now, we know we would need to find out if Trump gets a waiver, mm-hmm. but they're just looking to raise cash and take advantage
of liquidity. Dumb question. So if you want to sell a stock, you need to find somebody who wants to buy that stock from you. And if they just literally registered every share that is outstanding, and then plus some.
Well, they didn't. This is new shares.
Right, and, they're subject to a lockup.
Right, yeah.
Who's the buyer of this stock?
I would have said that at 68, at 58, 48,
well, if you go look at the holders
28.
Page, there's after the top holder, there's not many holders. And if you're an institution and you looked at the financials of this company, right, you'd say to yourself,
financials.
It's that's not a going concern. And if you have investors, then you have a fiduciary responsibility to them. So
retail.
I just don't know.
Who
owns AMC? Who owns GameStop?
I know, but look where AMC and GameStop are. They tried to meme this thing. It's unmemeable, and now all there is stock for sale. So it's probably going to be a hat size in the not so distant future. Well, think about 90% of the companies that went public through SPAC over the last 5 years went to low single digits.
No, this is meme on steroids. We've already said that. I mean, including.
But you couldn't short it.
No touch on the short side.
So you couldn't short it because it was too expensive. You've been
cut.
So there usually is that incremental buyer when you're covering a short.
Now, by the way, there's some big heads out there. So, I mean, there are some hat sizes.
Well, his head is pretty big. So it could be a 13. He probably has a 13. 13 and 7/8 or something, maybe.
All right, let's move on. We've got news alert on Live Nation. The DOJ filing an antitrust suit. Julie Borson's got the details. Julia.
Well, not filing it yet, but the Wall Street Journal is reporting that the Justice Department will file an antitrust suit against Live Nation as soon as next month, and that currently the DOJ is preparing to file an antitrust suit. We have just reached out to Live Nation for a comment just moments ago. We have not heard back just yet, but the Department of Justice is alleging that specific claims the specific claims the department would allege could not be learned in this Wall Street Journal report, Melissa. But this is something that we've been hearing about for a while. We've asked Live Nation CEO Michael Rapino about the reports that this is in the works. Live Nation has said that they've been cooperating with any requests for information in the past. And in an essay published on Live Nation's website last month, the head of corporate affairs for the company sought to defend against the accusations that the company is a monopoly. And he said Ticketmaster does not set prices. Artists and teams do. So this is something that we've been expecting for a while. We do see that shares are trading down about 5% after hours, but it is on very light volume.
Julia, thank you. Julia Borson, Karen, you own Live Nation.
I've owned Live Nation for at least a decade, longer. I mean, they have a tremendous business. Their flywheel of, you know, sort of controlling arenas, having Ticketmaster, having the relationship with the talent. It's really quite an extraordinary business all around the world. They have been dogged by Ticketmaster and some other things for a while. I would not be surprised if, I mean, this is sort of a juicy one on the face of it for the FTC.
Yep. Meantime, Tesla dropping more than 5% today after the EV maker announced it will lay off more than 10% of its global workforce. Following the news, the stock has dropped more than 35% this year and is now at its lowest level since last May. CNBC's Phil LeBeau's got more on this. Hey, Phil.
Hey, Melissa, usually when you hear about 10% of a staff being cut, that's usually good for the stock. It gives it some support, perhaps maybe even moves higher. Not the case with Tesla today, in part because people are saying, is there something more that will happen here? 10% of the global workforce is being let go. They announced that in a company-wide memo today. That's approximately 14,000 of the workers, 140,000 workforce globally right now. The plan is to cut costs and increase productivity. In the employee email, Elon Musk said, "There is nothing I hate more, but it must be done. This will enable us to be lean, innovative, and hungry for the next growth phase cycle." The next growth phase, does it mean more deliveries? You would think that it would, although there's plenty of debate about whether or not they even top last year's delivery total of 1.81 million vehicles. Remember, they were down 8.5% in the first quarter compared to Q1 of 2023. As you take a look at shares of Tesla, remember that we get the Q1 results after the bell on April 23rd. And there's another reason why the stock moved lower today, Melissa. You had two key executives, Drew Baglino and Rohan Patel. Drew Baglino has been with Tesla since 2007, 2008, a really, really long time. And then Rohan Patel has been there since 2015. Those two executives leaving, that sort of fuels the idea that is out there among some investors of what's next? Where is Tesla going from here? We know that the robotaxi unveil is coming in August. We know that Elon Musk is a believer that full self-driving and AI are the future. That's the guidepost for the future of Tesla. The question is, do you buy that it's going to happen relatively soon, or do you sit there and say, it's further out? Those are the things that are weighing on the stock right now.
Yeah. Phil, thank you. Phil LeBeau. And increasingly, Wall Street thinks it's further out, too. Piper and Jefferies just today taking down their delivery numbers. Maybe no surprise after the last report. But still, this just sort of underscores the notion that the tides are turning a little bit in terms of sentiment on Wall Street with this name, Rebecca.
Well, beyond Tesla, I mean, there's a bigger picture issue here with EVs, which I'm sure you all have talked about many, many times. But when you look at things like market share, hybrids are getting almost double the market share of EVs in the United States, which is pretty extraordinary. And when you look at the cars being recommended by things like Consumer Reports, four out of the top 10 for this year are hybrids, not EVs. People feel more comfortable, and that gets back to charging stations in part. I mean, the government said they were going to build 5,000 charging stations. Right now, today, we have seven. Seven.
Seven?
Yes, seven. That came from this government bill that was passed in 2021. Now, there's 12 more being constructed, but you made the point of timing, right? Eventually, everyone can charge their car, but we're not there yet.
Right. Coming up, Salesforce shares dropping. The market's giving the potential deal the side eye. What has investors scratching their heads next? Plus, United Health kicks off a big slate of big healthcare earnings tomorrow. What the report could tell us about the impact of the company's recent ransomware scandal right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. Salesforce shares dropping on reports that the company is in talks to buy fellow software name Informatica. The stock seeing its worst day since December 2022. The deal would reportedly be priced at less than Informatica's Friday close. Those shares have more than doubled over the past year on hopes for a potential takeout. The stock, though, closing down 6.5% today. Dan, you thought this is an interesting story here.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it's not particularly sexy. And if you look at Salesforce over the years, we've heard of some names that they've wanted to acquire. They've acquired a lot of companies going back to Slack and MuleSoft and that sort of thing. But this is a company that is, you know, it's a data platform, if you will. And, you know, might it be accretive? They have similar gross margins. It's a much smaller revenue base than that of Salesforce. It's just not that interesting. And if they were able to get it at a good price, it makes some sense. This company went private to private equity, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, or was brought out out 3 or 4 years ago. So maybe it's interesting for CRM. It's not going to be interesting for investors anytime soon.
Well, it's also not interesting as interesting for CRM versus where their share price is. In other words, they're not buying with an overpriced currency and getting something that's very accretive to shareholders. It's actually like it trades at a significant discount to the other software names, which have been under a lot of pressure. So I just think, you know, software is under pressure here. But this announcement for CRM, who Dan rightly points, look, this is how this company's gotten to where they are, is through acquisition. So you shouldn't be concerned. I just think they're paying more on a relative basis.
Coming up, it's not just banks. Earnings season is underway, and one of the biggest non-tech stocks in the S&P is gearing up to report. We are homing in on UNH straight ahead. That's ahead of tomorrow's results. Mizuho's Jared Holtz will join us next to dig into what to expect after the insurer's rough start to April. Don't go anywhere. Fast Money's back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Healthcare earnings kick off tomorrow with United Health Group reporting before the bell. Investors watching how the insurer is dealing with the impact of a major cyber attack in February. That stock down over 15% in 2024, while the S&P healthcare ETF is about 1.5% higher. For more on what to expect from the healthcare sector this earnings season, we're joined by Jared Holtz, healthcare sector strategist at Mizuho. Jared, always good to see you. So it's a cyber attack, but it's also the concerns about medical loss ratio. So walk us through what we're expecting, because you actually have a specific number on the MLR side in terms of what they need to beat in order to have a higher stock price.
Yeah, for sure. So I think the MLR is by far the biggest consideration. Mm-hmm. The Change Healthcare situation is, you know, more of an accounting adjustment probably this quarter and next quarter. Very tough to kind of understand how much it's going to cost the company, but clearly there's going to be a big reconciling item and the street can kind of figure out what they want to do with it. But the medical cost trend has been the biggest story in healthcare, aside from obesity, probably this year. Things have been running very hot. Procedure volume is very strong. It's obviously detrimental for managed care. We'll see what United says tomorrow. And then we'll also have J&J, so we can kind of put those data points together to kind of come up with some sort of matrix of what's actually going on. But yeah, the medical loss ratio, I think, is number one in terms of order of importance, and we'll see what they say.
You said 84% is sort of that line in the sand.
Right.
Anything better would be better for the stock.
I feel like 84%. Uh-huh. I mean, I think the street's a little bit lower than that, but just given how poorly the stock has performed, sentiment obviously very negative for the group, which is rare. So you've got like a pretty low bar coming in. 84%, I think they do better than that. Stock can go up a little bit, but it's really about the commentary around utilization. Are they seeing any change of trend relative to what they've told investors at kind of like prior weeks, months through the quarter?
What are the extrapolations that we can make, if any, once we hear what the medical loss ratio is? Can we then extrapolate to device makers, you know, saying they can come in better than expected, or, you know, I don't know, dialysis center? I don't know what it is.
Yeah, totally. I think what they're going to do is they'll parse out stronger and weaker segments of the business as it relates to procedures. So they could call out oncology, cardiology, orthopedics. I'm sure investors are going to take what they say at face value and kind of trade stocks accordingly. And also for the managed care group, what they've got to say on Medicare versus commercial and how that came in.
Okay. And then in terms of extrapolations within insurance, better than expected means better than expected probably for whom?
I would think for most of the companies, depending on what they have to say about the complexion of earnings, whether it was driven by Medicare patients, commercial patients on kind of employer-based insurance packages, things of that nature. But I feel like if they beat MLR, the entire group is going to go up quite a bit tomorrow.
Right. Johnson & Johnson also reports tomorrow before the bell. Is it all about talc?
I don't think it's all about talc for the quarter. Unfortunately, I think it's a lot about talc for the stock. It's right. Just been such an impediment for broader-based investment. The numbers have actually been decent for J&J. I mean, I think we can kind of question the long-term growth rate of pharma. There's not a ton there in the pipeline. I think if you spoke to investors in the space, they would kind of tell you they don't love this pipeline here. But they're obviously doing acquisitions. They did a $13 billion deal last week in MedTech. It's just been a tough ride with the talc as an overhang.
All right. Jared, thanks for coming by. Always nice to see you.
Thank
Jared
you.
Holtz of Mizuho. Quickly, you're in Elevance.
I'm in Elevance. I would love to see an MLR that comes in. I'm wondering, though, United Health has just done the stock terribly.
Yeah.
Could that actually be a buy? It's so bad. Hasn't traded at this kind of earnings level for a long time.
Yeah, I will quickly, I'll suspend
remind
the rules.
Me.
I will
she
quickly
has good
go
we have
back
good buy
to the
guest.
Could UNH be a buy here? It's so bad. Just really quick, we're out of time.
I think the buy thesis on UNH and for the broader group is actually an election trade. Okay. I think we can kind of see how numbers come out tomorrow. I'm not sure it's a buy in front of the quarter. I mean, it's too late now.
Yeah.
But it might be just a buy on strength or a buy on weakness. If things get overly weak and the multiple compresses, it might be a buying opportunity for long-term investors. And I think there is an election trade at some point for the group.
Thank you again, Jared.
Thank you.
Up next, final trades.
Final trade time, Rebecca Patterson.
Okay, I'm going to say this really fast. Intervention risk is rising in Japan. If they intervene, the yen strengthens, the equity market goes down. That's your opportunity to add hedged equity risk, DXJ.
Nice. Tim.
Smart stuff as always at Rebecca. Boeing.
Karen.
Citigroup, and congrats to my sister, Stacey Feinerman, running the Boston Marathon again.
Oh, congrats,
3.5 hours. Nice.
Wow. Dan.
If UNH is down a lot tomorrow, I think you buy it.
All right. Thanks for watching Fast. Mad Money starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Fast Money Disclaimer.
From their innovative practice facility to unmatched views from the fairway, the PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with 5G solutions from T-Mobile for Business. Together, we're using AI-powered analytics to expand coaching tools and bringing fans closer to the pros with 5G-connected cameras. This is game-changing innovation. This is the PGA of America with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.